Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The United States Senate is closely divided in favor of the GOP, but Democrats are not sitting silently on the sidelines. Among those Democrats is Senator Jeanne Shaheen. She's recently announced she'll run for re-election in 2020, and as a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, she's keeping a close watch on volatile situations in Venezuela, Syria, and North Korea. Today on the program, a conversation with Senator Jeanne Shaheen about domestic and foreign policy, and we want to hear from you. What do you want to ask Senator Shaheen? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Just search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, thank you very much for being here today.
Nice to be here, Peter.
We have so much to talk about. We hope it'll be a listener-guided conversation as well. Listeners, again, the phone number 1-800-892-6477. So we'll start the program today talking about something that's on the minds of a lot of Americans today, which is the Mueller report. We're seeing reports that Special Counsel Robert Mueller is close to completing his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential campaign, whether there was any collusion between the Russians and the Trump campaign. Apparently, this could be closed within the next week or two. So what do you make of that news?
Well, I've heard lots of rumors. It's not clear to me, and Robert Mueller hasn't said when he's going to finish the report. So I think the important thing is that it gets finished. He has a chance to pursue all of the leads, all of the concerns that have arisen as he's been involved in the report, and that when the report is finished, that it's made public. I think that's the number one priority. I think it's very important for the people of this country to be able to see what's in this report.
Mm-hmm. So can you take us through the steps of what you would expect to happen once the investigation is complete? What would happen once we realize that he's done with this report?
Well, he would deliver it to the Justice Department. And as people may remember, if they saw any of the hearings around the new Attorney General Barr's testimony at the Judiciary Committee, there were a lot of questions about whether he would commit to making the full report public. He didn't really make that commitment. I had a chance to ask him about that as well when I met with him. And he said that his inclination would be to make as much public as possible, but there might be information in the report that was classified that might put individuals in danger if it were released, and so he was concerned about that. But I think we should all hold him to the fact that this report should be released. It's a report to the American people, and the American people need to see it.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about a report, are we talking about something similar to what Americans may remember seeing when Ken Starr was investigating President Bill Clinton?
I don't know what we're going to see, frankly.
Like a giant tome of information. We don't know.
Well, we know that the sentencing memo for Bill Cohen was 800 pages long.
Okay.
So I assume it will be lengthy. But I've also read the indictments for some of the other people who have had indictments handed down who have gone to jail, and those have been relatively short, 18, 20, 30 pages. So I assume it's going to be a longer report, but I haven't seen any parameters, and because he's the special counsel, he has the ability to make some of those determinations.
Mm-hmm. Is there going to be a component of this that only members of Congress will see, or will the public see exactly what members of Congress see?
I think it's not clear.
It's not clear. Yeah. And you mentioned Attorney General Barr. What is your level of confidence in him that he will be following up on what he says would be his level of transparency?
Well, I intend to take him at his word. Mm-hmm. If he does not, do what he said he was going to do, then we have the ability to subpoena the report. The House could subpoena the report. The Senate could as well. It's not clear that the Senate would do that, given the Republican majority. But I think there are other ways in which we can make sure that the information in the report gets to the American people.
Mm-hmm. The probe has been going on for 2 years now. As you mentioned, there have been some indictments, some guilty pleas already from several members of Trump's campaign, Paul Manafort, of course, and Roger Stone recently having been arrested. What do you make of these developments so far? Does that, in your mind, point to something greater, or is it sort of inconclusive?
Peter, I think we need to wait and see what the report shows. I don't think we should jump to conclusions. I think there are very serious issues that have been raised around the Russia's interference in our elections in 2016 and interference also in 2018. And I think it's important to point out to people that when we're talking about interference, we're not talking about trying to change vote totals. There was some evidence that they hacked into some of the some states' voter information lists, but there's no evidence that they changed vote totals. What they have done, and what they've done not just in the United States, but in Europe, in other countries, there's some evidence they've done some of this in Latin America, they have tried to influence public opinion. So they have hacked into people's accounts. There's pretty good evidence to think that they were involved in the WikiLeaks release of emails. And they have tried to sow uncertainty and confusion about the democratic process by trying to exacerbate divisions in the country. We know that they were on Twitter and email and involved in trying to promote Colin Kaepernick in his taking a knee at football games and in opposing what he did. So their goal is to undermine our belief that democracy and our government works. And that's what we need to make sure people are aware of.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from Ken regarding voters and voter suppression, voter fraud. Ken said, we hear a lot in the news about voter fraud, but not as much as I believe we should about voter suppression that is happening at both the state and local levels. Another area of concern are voting machines that are not being properly vetted and does not allow for the proper tracking of a vote. That was Ken's remark. And Ken says, what would you do to make sure, from a federal point of view, that all voters have the access they need to have their voices heard and properly counted? That's the comment from Ken. What do you think, Senator Sheehan?
Well, I agree with Ken. It's very distressing to see and to see people like Senator Mitch McConnell, who's the majority leader, go to the floor of the Senate and suggest that every American who is a citizen does not have the right to vote. That's a premise of our democracy, that everyone should be allowed to vote, regardless of what your income level is, regardless of your heritage, of where you live. And we're seeing that effort undermined in too many places around the country, and here in New Hampshire, where there is an effort to keep students from voting. That is very distressing. So I think at the federal level, as most people probably understand, states have control over elections, but at the federal level, we have control over federal elections. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do is to make it very clear, I think, in all elections, but certainly in federal elections, that people can't be denied the ability to vote.
Mm-hmm. So he also commented on voting machines. I don't know if the federal government could impose some kind of standard on voting machines.
Well, there is legislation that would provide additional assistance to states to help with voting machines. Here in New Hampshire, we have a paper trail. That's the goal, is to make sure that every voting machine has a paper trail. So if there is a question about the vote, you can go back and you can look at the paper trail and see how people actually voted. What we need to do at the federal level is to provide some assistance to states. We've done some of that. I think we need to do more.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that this isn't an issue of votes not being calculated correctly, but influence, whether it's on social
media. At least not to date.
At least not to date. At least not to date. So, looking forward to 2020, and given that a lot of people are scared that the disinformation campaign waged by Russia would continue, What could be done to sort of combat this kind of disinformation campaign that sways the votes and stirs up emotions and make people very angry and consequentially not terribly confident in the democratic process?
Well, I think people need to acknowledge that this is going on, and it's distressing that we have the President of the United States who's refused to acknowledge that there was Russian interference in our elections in 2016. So I think it's important for leadership up and down the official ladder to point out that this is a threat. It's a threat to our democracy, and to help make people aware of it, because that's the most important thing. Now, when people get their news from all kinds of sources that don't necessarily, aren't always reputable, don't have collaboration or cooperation, that often is online and from a friend that gets the information gets sent, it's very important for each of us to look at the information, to see who's behind it, to see if it's real, and to make decisions based on real information, not based on innuendo or something that's been sent three times by different people and we don't know the source.
So essentially our critical thinking skills need to step
Absolutely.
In here. Okay.
And we also ought to look at it in through our education system. You know, one of the challenges I think we have in our democracy right now is that we no longer provide civics in every school in the country. And that creates real challenges because people aren't sure how the government works sometimes. And we need to make sure that people understand how government's supposed to work, that they understand their rights as a citizen and their responsibilities as a citizen, and that people participate. And one of the exciting things to me since the 2016 election has been the number of people who have come out to who want to be part of the democracy, who are concerned about the direction that the country's going, and who want to get involved. And I think that's good for this country. It's good for our democracy.
Mm-hmm. Just a few more questions on related to Robert Mueller's investigation. And one is that President Trump's longtime personal attorney, Michael Cohen, is going to testify both privately and then publicly later this week. I was wondering what you expected to come out of the testimony, if anything.
I think we will hear more details around some of the issues that have already come up, the illegal campaign contributions. It's not clear to me, and I don't have any inside information. I'm not on the Intelligence Committee, so I don't have any inside information about what else might come up as part of his testimony.
Is there any anything you will be listening for, wondering if he will say or not say?
Well, I would be interested to see if he has any information that suggests collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians and what happened in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones and talk to our listeners. Again, if you have a question or a comment for Senator Shaheen, our phone number 1-800-892-6477. Let's talk to Elizabeth in Hampton. Elizabeth, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. This is a different topic, but very concerning. What about life-saving drugs that are made for pennies but are so expensive now? Can you think of anything we can do about that, you can do about it? You know, I, for instance, a little girl that just before Christmas died of because her mother couldn't afford insulin, which cost pennies to make. And she's diabetic, and she passed away.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you very much for your question. Senator Shaheen.
Thank you, Elizabeth. That is a terrible tragedy. My granddaughter has type 1 diabetes, so I know how critical insulin is to making sure that people with diabetes are able to remain healthy. And it's a travesty that we have companies, the major companies who produce insulin, and the product has not changed in almost since it's been on the market, and yet the cost of that insulin has skyrocketed. So I think there are a number of things that we can do to address the high cost of prescription drugs, which is one of the things that's driving the cost of health care. First of all, we need to make sure that people have access to health care, and we need to make sure that that health insurance that's available to people provides for prescription drugs, that it provides for what we have called essential health benefits, hospitalization costs, primary care, the kinds of things that people need on a daily basis. Now, with respect to prescription drugs, there are a number of things that we can do today if we can get agreement. And the Trump administration, the president has said this is one area he wants to see some action in, so I hope that he means that and he's going to work with those of us in Congress to try and do something. I have legislation that I introduced several weeks ago that would prevent pharmaceutical companies from getting a tax subsidy for their advertising. Direct-to-consumer advertising, what you see when you turn on the television, has increased dramatically in the last 20 years, and the cost have increased as well. And those costs are not only passed along to consumers when they buy prescription drugs, but then pharmaceutical companies are able to deduct those costs off their taxes. So we basically pay twice. So I think we should eliminate those subsidies. We also should allow reimportation of safe drugs from Canada and other countries. We know that we have many people in New Hampshire who go to Canada to buy prescription drugs because they're so much more expensive. We also need to allow the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies for the drugs that are provided through the Medicare program. This is something that was prohibited under the Bush administration when we put in Medicare Part D, and it means that we are not getting the best prices for prescription drugs. Unlike the Veterans Administration, which is able to negotiate, and if you talk to anybody who gets their drugs through the VA, they're getting a much lower cost on prescription drugs than people who are on Medicare. So there are a number of things that we could do immediately if we had the commitment and the inclination to do that. Longer term, this has got to be an area that we look at long term, because this is what is helping to drive the high cost of health care.
Senator Shaheen, I'll continue on the theme of medical costs, because there's another piece of legislation that you co-sponsored recently, which would allow states to or allow people to opt in to a public option of some kind, to buy in essentially, right, to the state's Medicaid program. Would that address Elizabeth's concern, in your view, perhaps with respect to the cost of prescription medication?
Well, it would make access to prescription drugs more available,
but not necessarily less expensive.
Right.
Okay.
And we have a two-part problem. One is making sure people have access to prescription drugs when they need it, but the other is addressing the high cost of those prescription drugs. And we know, because we've had some CEOs of pharmaceutical companies who have been indicted because of the way they have driven up the cost of prescription drugs. So this is an area that we've really got to take a look at and see how we can long-term lower those costs.
Mm-hmm. But overall, in your view, a public option like this would increase access and would be a lower cost than private sector and not be a junk plan, in your view.
That's right. We don't need any more junk plans that don't provide real health insurance to people. When we passed the Affordable Care Act back in 2009, I supported a public option at that time as another alternative for people. Allowing people to buy into Medicaid, which has been so successful in New Hampshire, especially when it comes to treating the opioid epidemic, is something that we can do. I've also signed onto legislation that would allow people to buy into Medicare at age 50. Mm-hmm. So I think there are a number of things that we can do to help expand access to health care, and we need to really be as creative as possible, because what we have seen in the last couple of years is that this administration has sabotaged people's access to health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. They've done that by eliminating the amount of money that's available to try and let people know when enrollment starts. They have eliminated the navigators, those people who were so helpful in helping people to enroll, in a way that has really reduced the number of people who have enrolled in the health insurance.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, write in if you have questions as well. If you'd rather not call, our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. But if you'd like to call, 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Rick wrote in to ask, Senator Shaheen, Do you believe that Congress can effectively rein in the executive branch before it effectively destroys the representative balance of government in the United States? That's Rick's question.
I do. I think one of the encouraging outcomes of the 2018 election was taking back the House for Democrats, which provided some accountability for the administration and divided government in a way that I think is important to ensure that there is more responsiveness to the American people. There are a number of examples where the president in foreign policy, as Peter said, I'm on the Foreign Relations Committee and the Armed Services Committee, and there are a number of areas in foreign policy where the president has tried to take action and he has gotten overruled by the Congress. So when he tried to reduce the sanctions on Russia, for example, Congress overwhelmingly, in the Senate, it was 98-2, passed more expansive sanctions against Russia for their interference in the 2016 election. We've just seen that recently in response to the president's effort to withdraw troops from Syria, that there has been a reaction from Congress that says that's not what we ought to be doing. It's not in the best interests of our foreign policy in the Middle East. And the president has been forced to say that he's going to leave some troops in Syria and work with our allies there. So I do think there are examples that we can point to. I think the challenge is making sure that there is bipartisan support to rein in some of the excesses of this administration. I mean, the other one that I would point to very clearly is building the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Congress stood up to the president and said, no, we don't. The last Congress that had Republican majorities in both the House and Senate didn't build that wall. And now that we have a Democratic House and a Republican Senate, we're also saying we don't think that that's the best way to provide security at our southern border. So I think that's a very important example of where there has been an effort, a successful effort to rein in what the president's tried to do.
Mm-hmm. Though, to Rick's point, what can Congress do to stop the president regarding this wall construction project, trying to use military funds to do it, apart from speaking out and saying, hey, this is going to take money away from the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard or the New Hampshire National Guard Readiness Center in Plymouth? You can make those arguments, but apart from that, how can Congress stand in the way?
Well, those are arguments that I've made with the rest of the New Hampshire delegation, and there is legislation in the House this week that would overturn the president's emergency declaration. There are a number of states, I think 16 to date, that are filing a lawsuit against the president's emergency declaration. There are several private groups that are doing the same thing. So I think this is an area where the more citizens speak out, the better, to let their elected officials know, whether that be the state legislature, the governor's office, or the federal delegation.
Today on The Exchange, we're speaking with Democratic Senator Jean Shaheen. She's ready to take your questions as well, so send them by email. exchange@nhpr.org is the address. You can also give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. In the next part of the program, we're going to talk a lot about foreign policy, North Korea, China, Venezuela, Syria. If you have a question about that, send it along, exchange@nhpr.org. But we're also going to talk about more domestic policy later in the program, and you can call about that as well. Again, 1-800-892-6477. I'm Peter Biello. This is The Exchange. We'll be right back.
Civics 101 has done hundreds of shows about how the government works.
But we realized that we missed a step, something bigger.
Step right up, gentlemen. Don't miss your chance to commit treason.
Our nation, our government, is all built on paper and ink.
That's why we made a 6-part series on the founding documents, the pieces of paper that make us us, or rather, we. Subscribe or listen online at civics101podcast.org. Civics 101 is a production of NHPR.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and today we're talking with Senator Jean Shaheen. And in this part of the program, we're going to be talking about foreign policy, Senator Shaheen is a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And, Senator, let's start with North Korea in this part of the program. President Trump is scheduled to meet again this week with North Korean President Kim Jong-un. They held their first meeting in June, last year in June. A lot made of that summit. But, Senator Shaheen, did you see anything of value or substance coming out of that initial meeting?
Well, a decline in the antagonizing rhetoric, I think, was a value. That was helpful. But what we haven't seen is a list of all of North Korea's nuclear facilities. We haven't seen any plan for them to reduce their nuclear weapons. We've not seen testing since that summit. Again, that's a positive sign. But we haven't really seen any efforts to reduce their nuclear arsenal. And the evidence suggests that, in fact, they are continuing to make weapons.
Mm-hmm. So what, in your mind, would make for a successful meeting between these two world leaders this time around?
It would be to have to start with a list of where all of their nuclear sites are, how many weapons they have, how inspections might be done, a commitment to actually reduce weapons on some sort of a schedule. But in order to do that, there has to be a lot of work done outside of the summit meeting with the two leaders. And that work, my understanding is, has gone very slow, and we've seen very little progress.
Mm-hmm. But is slow better than nothing?
Slow is better than nothing. Mm-hmm. And a reduction in the inflammatory rhetoric is better than nothing as well. What we don't want is to see something happen as the result of escalating the attacks between the United States and North Korea. But we also need to see some real progress. Just because we're not seeing testing, just because the president says he had a good discussion with Kim Jong-un, doesn't mean that we're seeing real progress. What I hope we will not see is any kind of a commitment on the part of the president to withdraw our troops from South Korea. There have been rumors that that may be what he's thinking about. I think that would be a terrible decision, because not only would it affect North Korea and what's happening there, but it would send a signal to China that and basically give them free rein throughout Asia and the South China Sea in a way that is not in America's interest and not in the interest of our allies, Japan, South Korea, Vietnam, the Philippines, our other allies in Asia.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying under no circumstances should the U.S. withdraw troops from South Korea, or is there a circumstance under which that might be a worthy trade?
Well, I'm not going to speculate on what the circumstances might be. Certainly, we would have to see a lot more than we've seen right now from North Korea on what they're really doing. You know, if we could be assured that North Korea had eliminated all of its nuclear weapons off the Korean Peninsula, then maybe we should discuss that.
Mm-hmm. To what extent do you think the North Korean government is negotiating in good faith with the United States and not, as some critics have said, simply enjoying the fact that they're being given so much attention from the President of the United States?
Well, it seems they are clearly enjoying that and hoping to have more relief from sanctions against them that would allow more money to flow into their economy. But again, we should not be talking about deliverables until we've actually seen what North Korea is willing to do. And so far, we haven't seen that.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, give us a call if you have questions, particularly about foreign policy in this part of the program. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Let's talk to Brennan in Manchester. Brennan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Brennan.
Senator Shaheen, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Doing okay. I just had a question regarding your stance on our troops in Syria. So having looked at previous rhetoric from the Democratic Party regarding foreign engagements, especially in you know, like Iraq and Afghanistan, and even President Obama during his, you know, when he was running as a candidate, I found that the rhetoric was often focused on pulling out of the Middle East, which is actually very popular with the American people in general, which is why I think Trump is doing it, especially Syria. So my question is, as a Democrat, as someone who's, you know, as someone who's part of a political party that, you know, at least used to have the proclivity to want to disengage from long-term military endeavors abroad, wouldn't you think it would be wise that the fact that the president, even now that we've dealt so much damage militarily to the Islamic State, to bring our, you know, men and women home? I mean, I've got family in the military, and I would hate to see a long-term engagement get more of our men and women killed. You know, it doesn't seem to really line up with what seems to be an effective foreign policy plan. And I know there's a little, maybe they may have put a lot of opinion out there, but my general question is, why are you supportive of keeping our troops in Syria? I mean, most people would like to see them come home.
Thank you, Brennan. Really appreciate the call. Senator Sheehan.
Well, first of all, I would agree. I don't want to see any of our men and women who are serving in the military in harm's way. And every time we lose someone, it is a real tragedy. But we do not currently have a strategy in Syria. And Syria is a very important gateway in the Middle East, where we are seeing a civil war that's been going on now for 7 years that has displaced millions of people and killed hundreds of thousands of Syrians. It was a foothold for ISIS that happened because we withdrew from Iraq and allowed ISIS to gain another foothold, even though we have basically destroyed the caliphate, which is the land area that ISIS controlled. What we have not done is destroyed ISIS. The estimates are that there are 20 to 30,000 ISIS fighters who still exist in Syria and Iraq. And one of the important efforts of maintaining some troops, both the United States and some of our allies there, is to make sure that ISIS doesn't regain a foothold in Syria as they did after we withdrew from Iraq. I had the opportunity to visit Syria last summer, and I was in Manbij, which is the town where the bombing occurred not too long ago, and four Americans were killed in a terrible tragedy. Senator Graham and I were in the restaurant that was bombed, and meeting with our troops and meeting with our Syrian Democratic Forces, our partners in Syria. And so it is a horrible tragedy. And what happens when people question our motivation to continue to maintain a presence is that we see that kind of terrorist acts on the part of ISIS and other terrorist groups. So I think one of the things that impressed me very much when I was in that northeast section of Syria was the partnership between our military and the Syrian Democratic Forces in defeating ISIS, the work that they had done. It was listening to the Syrians that we talked to who were so pleased and didn't want us to leave because our presence there had meant that there was stability. They were very concerned about what would happen with the Turks coming across the border and how the Turks might engage the Kurds on the Syrian side of the border. And we also have hundreds of foreign fighters that are being detained in Syria by the Syrian Democratic Forces that we are providing support to. It's not at all clear if we pull out what will happen to those foreign fighters. Right now, we are still trying to negotiate with countries in Europe to take them back. Some countries have been willing to do that. Others have not. Among those foreign fighters are two of the terrorists suspected in the killing of James Foley and three other Americans. The families of the Foley family and the families of the other Americans killed want to see those terrorists brought back to the United States, tried in a civilian court, and brought to justice. We need to make sure that that happens. So there are a lot of interests that we have in Syria right now. And if we pull out completely and we leave Syria to the influence of Iran and Russia and Assad, then I think it has long-term implications for the Middle East.
Senator Sheehan, we got a call from Pat in Chichester. Pat, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Senator Shaheen, I've talked with your staff quite a bit. I'm a retired combat veteran. When are you, as my elected representative, either going to authorize or declare our myriad wars in Syria, northern Iraq, Central Africa, Somalia, or bring our troops home under the War Powers Resolution in U.S. Code? You've mentioned that you're just waiting for the right time, but we know that the war is illegal in Syria.
I'm sorry, Pat, I didn't actually say I'm waiting for the right time. I said I think we have interests there, and it's important for us to maintain a presence in that section of Syria. We have legislation that we worked on in the last Congress. I have actually supported, I did, and when Barack Obama was president, I supported a war powers resolution on Syria. In fact, I was one of 10 people in the Foreign Relations Committee to do that. That never went to the full Congress. I have worked on legislation in the last Congress to do that as well, because I agree, I think it's important for the American people to say clearly to our men and women who are serving that we support these efforts, or if we don't, then let's bring our troops home.
Because I think that's what he was getting at, right? The fact that it's been hard for Congress to sort of make a formal declaration of war in all these places that we actually have troops doing that kind of thing.
Well, it is. And one of the challenges is getting agreement in the Senate and in Congress on what to do. As I said, I supported one of those resolutions back in 2013, I think, on Syria. That never made it to when President Obama drew a red line and said if the Syrians use chemical weapons, we should go in and take action. I was one of the people who voted to do that. Again, I worked on legislation in the last Congress also around a declaration of war that never got through the committee. So, unfortunately, it requires a lot of agreement in order to move forward on some of these issues.
Because it sounds like he may be, Pat from Chichester may be addressing a question of executive power in a way, the ability to sort of...
It is about executive power. It's also about the will of Congress to take action.
Well, that was going to be my question. Is it a lack of ability in Congress to rein in the executive branch, or is it a lack of political will?
Well, I think in the last Congress it was an unwillingness on the part of the majority in the Senate to be willing to take action that might not agree with what President Trump was doing. Mm-hmm. And I think the same was true under President Obama, that there was an unwillingness on the part of the members of Congress to conflict with what the president was saying.
We got a question from Phil in Rochester who says, I'm very concerned with the way our policy is dealing with Venezuela. Maduro was elected in an internationally supervised fair election. Phil, some folks may dispute that was fair. The dire economic conditions, Phil continues there, are due in part to U.S. sanctions. The current situation recalls our long history of illegally interfering in the internal affairs of Latin American countries. The U.S. appears to be involved in the overthrow of a democratically elected government in order to gain access to large oil reserves for the benefit of U.S. corporations. Senator Shaheen, what is your position on Venezuela?
Well, I share some of your concerns about the appearance that the United States may be trying to overthrow a democratically elected government. However, I agree with Peter that the election of Maduro was not a democratic election. There's a lot of testimony to the fact that was not a free and fair election. I support the Trump administration's recognition of Juan Guaido as an interim president. And I think we need to see how this continues to play out. I hope that we will be able to send humanitarian assistance to the Venezuelans, because clearly the economic conditions are very dire. I don't support military intervention in Venezuela.
But I hope that we
will continue to take diplomatic action and to work with other countries in Latin America who have been slow in responding to what is obviously a humanitarian challenge in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm. Senator Shaheen, we learned recently that President Trump has nominated current U.S. Ambassador to Canada, Kelly Craft, as the next U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. What's your reaction to that news?
I have worked closely with Ambassador Kraft. I think she's done a good job in Canada. I think she has been very responsive and been willing to listen to concerns that have been brought to her, and I hope that she will be willing to do the same thing if she's confirmed as ambassador to the UN.
Listeners, we're chatting with Senator Jeanne Shaheen today about a variety of issues. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about domestic policy or foreign policy if you have more questions in that vein. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, which is where we are broadcasting a live video of this conversation today. This is The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Straws. They help you get the most out of your beverage. They make it easier to multitask, making efficient use of your time. And they help you get to the bottom of things. Sounds a little like NHPR, which is why, for a limited time, when you give $10 a month or more as a sustainer, you can choose a 4-pack of stainless steel NHPR straws. Those can come in handy whether you're driving into work or taking a break for lunch. Don't wait. Give now at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in today for Laura Kanoy, and we're talking with Senator Jeanne Shaheen about all the issues pertaining to American government today. Anything on your mind, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We just spoke a little bit about foreign policy, and I'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about China. So let's start there. It's been reported that President Trump is citing progress in trade talks with China and is delaying a March 2nd tariff deadline. That extension prevents the U.S. from increasing tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese exports from 10% to 25% on that date. Senator Shaheen, what's your response to that announcement?
Well, I think that's a positive step. I think there are many issues with China and trade and dumping products into our market and trying to eliminate American businesses. But I don't think the tariffs have been a very blunt instrument that we've used, and it's had a real impact not just on China but also on our own businesses. And for that reason, I don't think that's the best way to attack what China has done in terms of trade. But there's a bigger issue here with China, and I think we have been slow to recognize it. That is the economic power that China has amassed. They will soon surpass the United States as the biggest economy. They have diplomatic and economic assistance initiatives, the Belt and Road Initiative, where they're providing assistance to countries across Africa, across Asia, even into Europe. We're hearing, I had a chance last week to meet with the Prime Minister of Greece, who was talking about China's efforts to come in and provide aid to build a port there. So they are having increasing influence across the world, and we have been very slow to recognize that and to respond to that. The other thing China is doing, along with Russia, is they've developed weapons. This has been public in the last few weeks, hypersonic weapons that we are still developing a response to. So there is a real threat there, and we need to pay more attention to that. You know, people may remember early in January that the Chinese landed on the dark side of the moon, something the United States and no other country has done. And when China was landing on the dark side of the moon, our NASA researchers were not working because we were in a government shutdown. We cannot continue to remain competitive if that's our approach. We've got to understand the threat posed by China and prepare for that.
Mm-hmm. So to pay attention to China's growing influence in developing countries, to pay attention to their development of weapons, what does that mean in terms of practical action? Is there a practical action that we should take in conjunction with paying attention to China and what they're doing?
There is. We recently passed something called the Build Act in Congress that would allow us to be more flexible in how we provide assistance to other countries and how we encourage American businesses to do business in other countries. And We need to do more of that. We also need to look, we need to look at and be more focused at the military threats that we face. The National Defense Strategy that was produced last year says very clearly that the biggest threat to the United States now is not terrorism, it's great power competition, it's the threat from China and Russia, and we need to start focusing on how we're going to respond to that threat.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from Amy in Derry, who wrote to ask, the Health and Human Services Department, at the direction of President Trump, updated Title 10. The rule known as the domestic gag rule bars Planned Parenthood and any other provider that performs abortions or offers abortion referrals from receiving funding under Title 10, which pays for birth control and other family planning services for low-income patients. Amy continues, as a volunteer for Planned Parenthood, I wonder what steps Congress can take to ensure the continuation of these funds and the health services that they pay for. Senator Shaheen, what do you think?
Well, absolutely. We need to make sure that the funding under Title 10 is going as intended to families, that Planned Parenthood can continue to provide those family planning services. And one of the things that we can do in Congress is to make sure that as we're starting the appropriations process, that we don't allow the administration to cut off those funds. They have tried to do this in the last 2 years in the appropriations process. We prevented that from happening, and I have every reason to believe, especially given the Democratic control of the House, that we are not going to let that happen this time.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk to Dick in Concord. Dick, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hello, Senator.
Hi, Dick.
Nice to talk to you again. And I was just addressing issues around climate change because, as you know, the Department of Defense recognizes the urgency of addressing climate change. And time is really of the essence because if we allow permafrost releases of carbon, then the game's pretty much over. And a recent book, The Uninhabitable Earth, really outlines this in much the same way that Silent Spring did when Rachel Carson published that book. And I'm just wondering how you think, I know you care a lot about climate change, and I'm wondering how you think we can accelerate both federal and local activities to reduce our carbon footprint drastically in time to prevent these otherwise catastrophic results.
Well, thank you very much, Dick. Senator Shaheen.
Well, you're absolutely right, Dick. It is an existential threat, and we better start responding to it. Fortunately, in the private sector and at the state and community level, there's a lot of work going on to address climate change, to reduce carbon emissions. And thankfully, that will continue. It's very distressing that the Trump administration pulled us out of the Paris Accords, the climate agreement, and if he does not get reelected, we will have an opportunity to rejoin those accords. Unfortunately, they are not as robust in terms of the response as I think most of us would like to see. We need to see action by some of the other big polluters, China and India. And actually, China is taking pretty dramatic action, much more so than India, to address pollution. But my focus has been on energy efficiency because that's the cheapest, fastest way to deal with our energy needs. It's been something that we've been able to agree on, Republicans and Democrats, in a way that I think allows us to move forward. So while we're continuing to debate a whole lot of other ways to address our carbon emissions, energy efficiency is something that we can do today, and we should continue to do it. So I will continue to focus there, and I know that there are a lot of other efforts that are underway, and I hope that we can get some bipartisan agreement. You know, one of the positive things about the Green New Deal that has been introduced is that it has started a conversation again about the need to respond to climate change and to do it as soon as possible. You know, last week, last year, 10 years ago, we should have been responding. And we need to come together and figure out how we can address this issue to reduce carbon emissions. Because, as you point out, if we don't take action soon, it's going to be too late.
Would you sign on officially as a supporter of the Green New Deal as it's proposed right now?
I'm continuing to review it. Mm-hmm. What we need to do is to have it come to the floor. Senator McConnell has said he's going to have a vote on it, so we'll see when that occurs.
Mm-hmm. I imagine if you're interested in energy efficiency that you would like at least the provision in the Green New Deal that says buildings that exist now have 10 years to sort of come up to a new standard of efficiency. Is that something that you like about the Green New Deal?
Well, it is, but I think we got to be realistic, too. You know, we have a lot of people in New Hampshire who would really like to retrofit their homes to make them more energy efficient because they're more comfortable that way. They save money on their energy bills, but they may not have the money to do that. Mm-hmm. So we got to figure out how we're going to provide the assistance that people need. Again, I have legislation that I've had now for three Congresses with Rob Portman from Ohio that would incentivize building codes in a way that would provide for dramatic savings in energy. It would be the equivalent of taking 22 million cars off the road. Mm-hmm. And we're still working on that. So we've got to get some agreement around how we're going to accomplish these goals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of the issue with the Green New Deal is that it's a resolution without a clear path, but more like
a set
of guidelines. Another one of the guidelines within the Green New Deal is an acknowledgement, at least on the part of the authors, that the impacts of climate change are disproportionately bad for people, for minority communities.
Right.
And so some...
For people with low economic means.
Yep, exactly. So part of the guidelines set out for the Green New Deal is that Congress would be mindful of that as they go about trying to create new jobs in clean industries and addressing some of the things like the energy efficiency thing that we just spoke about. So I guess my long-winded question to you, is that another portion of the Green New Deal that you would support?
Well, yeah, one of the great things about the new energy economy is all of the jobs that are being created. And we need to figure out how to incentivize those jobs in a way that provides more opportunities for Americans, that provides energy savings for families. So I think there are lots of opportunities there, and we need to think about how we can come together around that. But it starts with recognizing the science of climate change. And to me, one of the most disturbing things about this debate has been all of those people who continue to say climate change is not real, that the science is not real. That just totally misses science that everybody agrees on now. So to continue to use that as a reason to not do something about climate change is just a red herring. It's totally bogus, and we need to get serious about this issue.
You recently announced that you're going to run for a third term in the Senate.
I did.
Can you spell out for us maybe one or two of the major initiatives you'd like to push as a candidate in 2020?
Well, one of the issues that I continue to work on, and one of the areas where I am most proud of my work over the last several years, is about getting more resources to address the opioid epidemic. As we know, almost every community in New Hampshire, almost everyone you meet knows someone who has been affected by the tragedy of substance use, misuse. And we were able to get a significant amount working across the aisle over the last 3 years. Including 2019, we're going to have about $7 billion to help provide resources to address the opioid epidemic that will help with treatment, that will help with law enforcement and interdiction, that will help build a pipeline of treatment providers to address this epidemic. We were able to get a set aside for states hardest hit, so New Hampshire has the second highest overdose death rate in opioid related drugs of any state in the country. We were able to go from about 3 million in 2017 to in 2018 and 2019, we're going to get about 24 million. It's one of the things that's helped the state set up the hub and spoke response to provide treatment. So I will continue to work on that. That's something that we need to stay at until we've beaten this epidemic.
Mm-hmm. Other questions pertaining to 2020, if we have some time for that. You spoke at the New Hampshire Democratic Party fundraiser on Friday night, where presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren was the keynote. And you gave Senator Warren some pretty high praise, saying that she was a force to be reckoned with. So, crowded field of Democrats, what do you think of Elizabeth Warren's chances specifically here in New Hampshire?
You know, Peter, I'm not going to endorse any candidate in the presidential race because I have my own Senate race to run. I've offered help for everybody who comes to New Hampshire.
You're not going to endorse at any period?
I'm not going to endorse at any period,
okay.
No. And that includes Elizabeth Warren, it includes Sherrod Brown, it includes Amy Klobuchar, Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris. I mean, it's anybody who is coming to New Hampshire, I'm happy to provide, answer questions, provide any assistance that I can, but I'm not going to endorse.
Okay, but short of that, thoughts on Elizabeth Warren's candidacy?
Well, again, as I said Friday night, I'm glad she's in this race. I think she's raising critical issues that are important to the country.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the people running for president are your Senate colleagues.
They are.
So is that having an impact at all with your ability to sort of discuss things with your fellow senators? If they're off on the campaign trail, in other words, you can't really chat with them about what you need to chat with them about?
Well, not so far. It's early in the process, so it's not clear how it will play out, but at this point, no.
Mm-hmm. We had a question from Jared who wanted to know your thoughts on voting changes such as ranked choice voting, open primaries, and modified blanket primaries.
I had a chance to observe Maine, as I'm sure you did, in the last election. They were using ranked choice in some of the races, not all of them. It is complicated, so I think it takes some time to phase in. But listen, my first choice is to make sure that everybody who is 18 gets registered to vote. I think we ought to make it a whole lot easier to register to vote. You turn 18, you ought to graduate from high school with a diploma in one hand and a voter registration card in the other. I think we need to make sure that people can vote, that polling hours are such that people can actually make it to the polls, people who have to work. I think we should stop trying to prevent young people and people of color and people with low economic means from voting. That's where I think we ought to start in terms of our voting process.
Should Election Day be a national holiday?
You know, there are still people who have to work even on national holidays, so I don't know that that gets at what we're fundamentally trying to get at. There are a lot of people who think the answer is vote by mail or vote at home rather than having a national holiday.
Well, Senator Shaheen, so much to talk about. We appreciate you spending the hour with us and sharing your
views. Nice to be here.
Thank you very much. And listeners, remember, the conversation continues online at nhpr.org and at our Facebook page. Just search for NHPR Exchange. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our public radio fellow is Ali Oshinsky. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.